This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Ken Craig. Today is July 23rd, 2004. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, in the Vietnam Archive interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Craig, you are again in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And it is approximately 5 after 1 o'clock Central Standard Time, 5 after 2 Eastern Time. Ken, let's start with where we left off, and we basically had finished discussing your second cruise in 1972. I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about anything else that has come to mind about that, and if nothing has, we can move forward with where you went after when you finished that cruise. Is there anything else that you want to discuss about that that 11-month
cruise?
Not
really. I thought it was, as I stated before, it was an extremely thrilling cruise. I think we did a good job, and I was kind of sorry to leave the squadron when I did. I left in November, which was right before the Linebacker 2 bombing in, I believe, December of 72.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have loved to have been there for that, but
right.
I had orders out of the squadron to report to PG school at Monterey, California. So I went back to Whidbey Island from the Philippines, left the ship, and flew back commercially to Seattle and mm-hmm. was reunited with my family.
What was that like flying out of Vietnam and leaving the squadron?
Well, it was difficult because I was leaving a group of people that I'd had a lot of respect and admiration for, and
right.
I didn't feel the job was completed, but we didn't know what the extent of the war was going to be, whether it was going to be more of the same, long delays, and then
right.
getting back into it. So there was a lot of uncertainty at the time that I left, whether we were just going to continue this thing forever.
Right.
Feeling it has been going on so long without any decisive results that we just didn't know what the future held.
Did you have a desire to leave? I'm sure you wanted to see Sandy and
the
children.
Well, yeah, certainly
but
it was nice to be reunited, but no, I didn't really want to leave because I liked, like I said, I really enjoyed the flying aspect of it.
And, mm-hmm.
and my position in the squadron as ops officer, I really thrived on it and enjoyed it. I thought we were making good progress.
Right.
So I wasn't at all happy to leave. But
did you,
I knew it, I just had to do it.
Did you request it, or was it time?
No, it was just a normal rotation.
Okay.
And I knew that there wasn't any free way to, you know, ask for a couple of months extension or anything else, because I had a starting date at PG school, which I thought was important.
Right. Okay. Why don't we talk about getting into that, but actually before that, any problems when you came into Seattle?
No. No.
Okay. Were you in uniform?
I don't believe I was.
Okay. Okay.
I think I was in civilian clothes.
Tell me about Monterey and PG school.
Well, I went to the family at Monterey just before Christmas and settled in as a student there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an enjoyable experience. I was a little apprehensive because I didn't feel I was a great student at the Naval Academy, but I found the studies in that environment were, maybe I had matured, but I had no trouble with the studies. In fact, I did fairly well.
Okay.
And got a master's in economics. Well, it was actually management. It was a degree in management,
mm-hmm.
but with an economics subspecialty.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. I took a lot of accounting classes and over what I was required to do because I thought that was an interesting field.
Right.
So I got a good, I thought it very enjoyable time. Sandy had a difficult time in Monterey just through the adjustment, but we weathered it and it was. One of those things. She just, you know, she had been, I guess the pressure had been released from the pressure cooker and,
right.
and it was tough on her. But
adjusting to having you back home again? Is that?
No, I think it was more of a mental thing where she just, you know, just had a hard time with, it was in a way a little bit of a midlife crisis before midlife, if you
right.
know what I mean.
Right.
But I just, patient, and in no short order, she was right back to where she had been. But I think just the fact that I was home after all the time that she'd spent
right.
worrying about me and everything else, and I think it made it was just a relief.
Right.
She took some courses there. They one of the first times we were at a cocktail party, it was sort of like new students meeting the faculty at the mm-hmm. cocktail party, and she got in talking to some professor there, I think the head of one of the departments, and she said she's very interested in finding out what we were, what the school had to offer, and they said, well, you can come and audit the course if you want to, even take it if you wish for
mm-hmm.
credit. And
mm-hmm.
Andy was very surprised, so was I, because I didn't think they did that. And so she took a Mideast political course,
right,
and really got learned a lot about the Middle East, far long, about the right time actually, but before everybody was terribly interested about it. So
mm-hmm.
she had a very good fundamental grounding on the Middle East politics and,
mm-hmm.
and what we're engaging in today.
Right, right.
We also befriended a South Vietnamese officer who was an exchange student then, and it was later he was one of the people that were lucky enough to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very enjoyable time. Of course, he was dirt poor when he came over here. So we kind of took him under our wing and made sure he had plenty of food and
mm-hmm.
and had a family, because he missed his family dearly.
Now, he escaped from the fall after 75?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And did you meet him happenstance?
Well, he was a student at the War College, or at the postgraduate school.
Right, but he, so you had a class with him, or you just ran into
right.
him? Right. Okay.
Yeah, I had classes with
I
him.
I understand. Okay. Did he talk to you about his experiences in the war?
Yes, he did.
Really?
And he was a naval officer, obviously, and he was fighting the same kind of battle I was, but it was certainly a lot more. The experience was really nice, and the kids loved Mr. Naw.
Right.
And we had some other good experience. We had other foreign officers which we associated with. I enjoyed doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We sponsored one Filipino who was the most autocratic person I've ever met in my life. Came from a rich family, and he was not at all one of my what I would consider one of my friends. We tried to do everything for him and his family, and they didn't appreciate anything was done for him.
Really?
Not sad. Yeah.
Why, do you think?
I don't know. I think maybe he had something, or maybe he's one of those people that didn't like the United States and was very arrogant.
Why did you choose to sponsor him?
Pardon me?
Why did you choose to sponsor him?
Well, I just put my name in, and they assigned
oh.
people if he wanted to sponsor somebody, and,
okay.
and it was the luck of the draw.
Okay. So how long did this last, the PG school?
2 years.
Okay.
Actually, I guess a year and a half.
Was it hard for you, Ken, to adjust back to life stateside?
No,
off
not
the
at all. I was,
okay.
you know, just delighted to be home.
Okay.
Delighted to be with have my kids around me again and my dog and
right.
And of course, Sandy.
Yeah. Did you talk about your Vietnam experiences with anyone?
Not really.
Was that by choice, or
no,
just didn't
ask? It's one of those
things
that you just put it in the back of your mind and you go on. It's not one of those things that you talk much about. I did get a lot of awards came in during that time, and of course was called to the Admiral to get my awards.
Mm-hmm.
That made some commotion, but not, you know, a lot of people were getting awards. I wasn't the only one.
Right.
Quite a few.
What do you mean it made some commotion?
Well, among my classmates and everything, when I was...
What kind? I mean, were they...
Just support.
They realized who you... Did they know what you had done? Or at that point,
no,
did they realize...
No, not really, because you don't talk about it.
Right. So, but at that point, they realized you had done something...
Well, you know, it was nice to get the rewards, and other aviators especially knew what the awards meant. Curious and supportive.
Do you want to talk about what those awards were?
Well, I got, for that cruise, I got one DFC and about five air medals, individual air medals, and quite a few strike flight air medals.
Uh-huh.
Some six, I think, Navy accommodation medals, plus the, I think the presidential unit citation came in at about the same time.
Right, right. Okay. Were you thinking at this point in your career that you were going to make the Navy a career for sure, or did you have any...
Well, as soon as I got into aviation, I was so happy with aviation, I said, I kind of made a pact with God that if he ever let me in, that I was going to, you know, if I got my wings, I would stay in for a career.
Right.
And I was happy with that choice.
Okay.
So I never had any doubts. I think I was pretty much career right from the start.
Right. So you graduated in 74, is that correct? You went in December 72?
Yeah. It was 73 and a half, I guess. And then I went to Armed Forces Staff College in Norfolk for almost 6 months, 5 months, I think, is the course.
Okay. Again, is this a natural...
So it was a total 2 year of education.
Okay. So after you finished this, the educational part, where did you go? Did you have a choice based on the fact that now you had this educational experience, this background? Or did you want to go back to flying immediately?
Well, of course, I wanted to go back to flying. And,
right.
And I was going back to shore duty, so the best opportunity in the world was I went back to... medium attack wing staff at Oceana, which I became assistant readiness officer and then readiness officer. So that was a sort of like being an ops officer, but a whole wing.
Right.
And that's primarily training. So it was right up my alley based on the fact that I'd been an instructor in the RAG right across the street.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd had the experience that I've had, so it was natural. I mean, I enjoyed that job.
What was the airframe you were instructing in? Was it the A6? A6?
Yes.
Okay. And how long were you there in Oceana?
For about a year and a half, I believe it was.
Okay.
And it was right at the end of my staff college experience. I got selected for command. So, we call it a stash job. It's a job that they put you in, and they know that you only have a certain amount of time before they're going to pull you out and put you into a squadron for your XO when the billet, you know, when the billet comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I was placed, and it was a great, great job, and I loved it. I got to fly.
Where was this?
At Oceana.
At Oceana, okay. And how long were you in that position?
About 18 months.
Okay. And... this is when you commanded the squadron, or you're going into that?
Yeah, I was going from there to XO.
Okay.
And then CO of the squadron. That's the way the aviation units do it. They send somebody as their, the same person will go as XO, and then you just what they call fleet up to CO.
Right.
And that's about, the total length of time is about 3 years in an active squadron again.
Okay.
So that's all fleet duty.
Did you... Okay, where did this happen? When you became XO and
then
CO?
Then they weren't going to move anybody. It was the crunch time again with funding. They weren't going to transfer anybody to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandy and I said, here we go again. So I went to the West Coast for my command tour.
Okay, where did you go?
I went to Whidbey Island to VA 95 eventually. I went through a little bit through the RAG.
Mm-hmm.
196 out there before you reported as XO. And but since I was pretty current in the A6, it was a really short course
right
for me.
Right.
And then I reported as XO to in VA 95.
What year was this, Ken?
Let's see, 76, I guess.
Oh, 76, when you became CO?
No, CO was a year and a half later.
Okay. 78.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you describe what a CO of a squadron does? What did you do?
Well, number one, you're responsible for everything that goes on in that squadron, and that's literally. You have to set up a training program in your squadron to train your people, whether it be maintenance or whether it be operational. And you're responsible for the care and welfare of, at that time, about 350 people. So it was an interesting and fun job. I really enjoyed the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
We were, we went on cruise pretty rapidly after I joined the squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the cruise with XO, of course.
Right.
And that was the Coral Sea, which was the sister ship of both the Roosevelt that I'd been on first in A4s, and then Midway, which is a class sister ship.
Right.
And now I was on the Coral Sea, which I thought was interesting, three cruises on all of three Midway-class carriers.
Yes.
And we went to Westpac and had a good Westpac cruise,
mm-hmm.
very safe one,
mm-hmm.
in standards, relative standards. And I forgot to mention on talking about safety that in I told you that we hadn't lost anybody to combat when I was there on that squadron, but we lost two people to aircraft accidents in 115.
Really?
Yeah. One of them landed, broke his gear because I think he was had too much. He landed with too much ordnance on one wing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he broke his landing gear, and as he was sliding down, the Bombardier Navigator ejected and unfortunately impacted the crane. So he was killed. And we had Ray Donnelly, who was shot through the head.
Right.
That was a combat loss. And let me see, what was the other one?
That's when he was actually out there just flying, and
he took a
round directly.
Lucky shot.
Yeah.
And that was can I go back to that? Or
of course you can. Absolutely.
That was an interesting night because...
this is VA 115, right?
Yeah, this was 115 in 1972. And Mike McCormick was the pilot, and Ray Donnelly was the BN. And we got a call saying they were coming back to the ship. I was down in the ready room. So when they came back and landed, I was up on the flight deck, because he was the last to come aboard.
Mm-hmm.
They cleared the deck for him. And he came aboard, and I knew everybody was going to be concerned about Ray because he was slumped over in the cockpit, apparently. And that, at least that's the report. We didn't know at that time he was dead. But it was a horrible experience for Mike because blood was all over the cockpit. And, of course, the hole in the windscreen had made the cockpit unbearably noisy with all the wind flow.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mike got it back aboard ship, but I knew he was going to be needing some support, so everybody rushed over to the side that Ray was on. I rushed over to the side and got up and helped Mike get out of the airplane and took him to my room before the debriefs and everything started, and
mm-hmm.
sat him down and let him collect himself and gave him a shot of something, and helped him acclimate, I guess you'd say, before he was put through the million questions.
Right.
So he was very, very upset, and as well can be imagined, it was a terrible emotional situation for him to lose his good friend like that.
Yes. Was he able to continue flying?
Yes, he did, and then later he was flying with Al, and they were shot down or lost.
Right.
In that campaign later on in December, he was.
Right. Is that difficult for you, Ken, today to think about that night and things like that? When you talked a lot about your ability to put the fear in the background and just do your job and be aggressive at it and do the right thing and et cetera. And when something like this happens, I know it can only be, I can't imagine what it would be like then, but what is it like for you now to think about that?
Well, I didn't give it a great deal of, I mean, I this may sound unfeeling, but I don't dwell on things a lot.
Right.
I'm not a dweller. And so I just consider it as part of one of the, you know, experiences of a lifetime, and I don't dwell on much of the implications or concerned about it. Now, of course, I'm very concerned about the families. We paid for a ticket to send, to bring Tanya up to Monterey, because when that happened, I was out of the squadron, when Mike was shot down, and Al Clark was shot down, we knew that Tanya was probably having a hard time. And so we, Sandy and I, bought her a ticket, ran her a ticket from up to Monterey, and asked her to come up and see us.
Mm-hmm.
And she did. And we, you know, just, we didn't talk about anything about the war. We just went out and had good dinners and had some good times and everything else. And I was trying more than anything just to make sure that she knew she had friends if she needed them. And,
right.
And everything like that.
You saw her again this past January.
That's right.
In Arlington.
Right.
Had you all kept in touch?
No, surprisingly enough, she didn't keep in touch with us at all. We offered to, but we didn't question that she didn't want to or whatever. She might have had her own reasons. We don't know.
Right.
But we tried to make it as pleasant for her as we could, and that's the way it was.
So as XO on board the Coral Sea, speaking of safety and accidents, I mean, I assume you had a contingency plan for, or an SOP for a situation where you lose an aircraft.
Oh yes, every squadron has.
Yes.
One.
What would you do in that situation? Can you walk us through that?
Well, basically, they have it's like a book, and you have notification, official notification that you have to do. For the chain of command, that has to be notified that there's been an aircraft accident, where, how, why, anything that you know about it at the time. And what that does is set in motion a series of events within the Navy.
Yes.
Of one of which is the safety center at Norfolk will get involved, and within the squadron you set up two investigations. One, the safety investigation, and the other is a JAG investigation.
Mm-hmm.
JAG investigation is for legal claims against the government, and it has, it's a legal body that can, the proceedings can be open to the public, whereas the safety investigation is for safety only. It can't be used in a disciplinary manner, and therefore, any witnesses who come forth are protected, and there is no claim. No claim can be made against them in a disciplinary fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And what you want to do with that board is determine what caused the accident, how can we prevent future accidents from occurring, what are the weaknesses in whatever the chain of causation, and then they'll make a report which goes all the way up to the chain of command, all the way to the CNO,
mm-hmm.
Chief of Naval Operations, who will finally sign off on it. But basically, and all the endorsers have an opportunity to put their endorsement on the report. So the CO may say, this is the cause of the accident, or at least this is what we believe was the accident, and these are the factors. And others, people can claim that, well, there's other issues involved as well. So everybody gets a chance to comment on what might have caused the accident or what they believe were the factors that were involved in it.
Right. Okay.
Then on the squadron level, of course, you have to notify, the CO has to notify the next of kin.
Right.
And we had, in my squadron, when I was the CO, we had an accident and lost two people. And of course, so I'm very familiar with not only being at the safety center and directing these kind of things, I was aware of it on a personal level, what it goes from the CO's point.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to notify all the next of kin, and of course, if you're on crew, that's done by somebody else. But if you're in the local area and it happens, you have to go out and personally talk to the families involved.
Mm-hmm.
You send the Navy Department sends letters to next of kin that are away from the area, for instance, parents, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so. But all of this, there is a lot of administration that is involved anytime you lose an aircraft.
Yes.
Except in the combat situation.
Yes. While we're in the 1970s, let me ask you some questions about the war. It ends, obviously, for the United States in 73, and then the war goes on for another 18 months, and Saigon falls in April of 1975. How much did you keep up with the war when you came?
Oh, well, of course, I was avidly interested in reading about it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I didn't mention the other day, you said, how did you follow the war when you were going on in the Mediterranean cruises and all like that?
Yes.
Well, the Navy, of course, had a lot of intelligence analysts reports, and they were available to people who had a need to know these things. And
right.
I read those analysts' analyses and when I was on the cruise, so I kept up not necessarily through the newspapers, but through the official reports.
Right. Tell me what you felt in April 75 when you saw what was going on.
Well, I was delighted that Nixon started getting serious about ending the war. I was delighted about that, especially if we weren't going to go in to win, we might as well get the heck out of a quagmire and get our guys back. And so I was delighted to see, first of all, the mining effort, which we in the squadron participated in. We dropped mines.
Yes.
And that was a good feeling because we knew then that they were serious.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I wasn't there for a linebacker, too, but from an armchair, I certainly cheered it and just wished I'd have been in on it. Because I knew it was going to be really hot and really good targets.
Mm-hmm.
I was delighted to see them tighten the wrench, or tighten the screws, actually.
Right. And when the United States is out and then South Vietnam falls, what went through your mind?
Well, I was disappointed, of course, because there, in my humble opinion, there was no need for that failure.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a failure of our will and our political resolve. It wasn't a failure of military arms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I was disappointed. And more than that, I was disappointed in the people like Na, who I had gotten to know, who are really good people.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew there was millions more of good people who were going to be subjected to a totalitarian society and regime. And they still are. They're still suffering.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that the Vietnamization policy would work, this effort by the Nixon administration to kind of turn the war over to the Vietnamese using American equipment and things like that? Was this something viable? You're kind of removed because you're out there on the carrier.
Yeah, I'm kind of removed from that, but from a standpoint of knowing how weak the society was and the fact that the communists, before we even got pretty much involved in it, they were decimating the people that should carry on the society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've been doing that since the French Wars. And the teachers and anybody who had foreign training, university training and things like that. So they'd systematically done a pretty good job of cleaning the country out of anybody who was strong enough to speak up. And so there weren't a lot of people that were left that you could say would be a really effective organizing force for any kind of a political activity. And the communists were relentless. I mean, they just continued to undermine everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't confident that South Vietnam had enough leadership to be able to counteract this communist force that had been in place for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And we could say all we wanted about body counts, but the fact was they were winning the minds of the people by assassinating anybody that didn't agree with them.
Right.
It was effective. And so if you didn't have absolute control over any given piece of real estate, the communists were there and were in charge.
What about that body count policy? What did you think of that?
Oh, I thought it was stupid. But that was a way to somebody to justify that we were doing something over there.
Right.
But anybody who's fought in the jungle or seen a jungle would understand that body counts are not necessarily too important. That's not the determinant. But that was typical McNamara. He was a bean counter.
Mm-hmm.
And he had devised all these measures of effectiveness. And he did it, I believe it was a Ford Motor, where he was Ford Motor?
Yes,
yeah.
Ford Motor Company.
He did the same kind of thing there, and then he was with the Air Force, and was a civilian working for the Air Force, I believe, early in his career, and
mm-hmm.
Got into that stuff, and he was a big systems analysis guy. Well, I had enough courses about systems analysis at postgraduate school that I understand exactly all these things, and it's not bogus. It's very useful in manufacturing and things like that, but when you try to put it into arcane things like effectiveness of military action,
mm-hmm.
hey, it breaks down pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't have any other good measures. It wasn't a number of bombs dropped or bullets fired, or, you know, he had to have something that said, okay, I've got, for every engagement I've had, bodies. Well, that's not going to hack it.
Right.
And so I was, and of course, the news people are part of the problem, because they love something like that they can say, oh, yes, we got counts today.
Right.
We can report counts. It's like if you count airplanes shot down, that's one thing, but a body, that's, I don't know, not terribly helpful.
What did you think of the media coverage of the war?
Very slanted. As the war got on, it got worse.
Uh-huh.
When it was first there, and especially the, you know, you might even remember the movie The Special Forces, one with John Wayne.
Yes.
And that was all rah, 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 and,
mm-hmm.
and everybody liked that, and that was very supportive. But that was very early on, and the more you got into it, the more negative it became. And, of course, I think they allied with the peace group, and so, obviously, they were making a statement.
Right.
And I didn't think that the reporting was at all good, nor do I think it's good today. Everything is negative.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is that they focus on is losses mm-hmm. and bombs exploding and everything else. Nothing about the life of the poor guy in the street.
Right. What were your thoughts on the anti-war movement?
Well, I obviously didn't have much regard for them either.
Right.
And I cannot stand Jane Fonda and her ilk to this day. And obviously, John Kerry is not high on my list either.
Right.
Because basically, I think they were traitors.
Because of their outspokenness against the war.
Well,
during the war.
I'm not necessarily Kerry. Anybody who did it here in the United States that's not being a traitor. But when you go to a foreign land who's fighting you and champion their cause, like Daniel, I think it was Daniel Ellsberg went over there, and Jane Fonda and some other people. Can't remember all the names, but to me those were just plain traitorous acts that somehow this country is so democratic and nice will allow that to happen,
right,
even if it hurts us.
Right.
But I can never forgive any of them.
What about the guys in the squadron in 115? Did you all talk about the anti-war movement while you were over there on station?
I think we did, and I don't think most of us didn't support it at all. Now, there was various views of the war in 72,
yes,
much different than in 66, for example.
Yes. Tell me about those differences.
You had many more of the junior officers who were coming into the squadron had views that maybe we weren't doing the right thing there.
Right.
But I can say, I think from 100%, that nobody ever let those views get in the way of their work.
Mm-hmm.
They never, even if they were not totally supportive of the war, they never let that get in the way of their being professionals.
Right. Okay.
Which I think might have been different in other groups of combatants. But certainly not in my experience did I ever see anything that I considered any sabotage or lack of will to fight or any of that stuff due to the anti-war movement.
Right. Okay. Ken, let's continue with, we'll come back to some Vietnam material in a moment, but let's continue with your career. When you finished your cruise in the Coral Sea, where did you go?
Well, then we came back to Whidbey Island and went through another training program. And this one was, we were switched from one air wing to another. So, and the next air wing was going to go to the East Coast and be on the East Coast carrier, the America.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a long workup because of the timing and cruise periods and all that stuff,
mm-hmm,
where they had the scheduling. So we were at Whidbey for a fairly long time, and we went to a lot of training exercises because I tried to insist on this from the air wing,
mm-hmm,
to make sure that I didn't want people sitting around doing nothing.
Right.
I mean, usually when you're back at Whidbey or at any squadron and you're not deployed, you get the last call on resources.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not doing anything, you end up with fewer airplanes and less parts, and you end up not flying as much, and people,
mm-hmm,
it hurts morale, and it's not good for effectiveness of the squadron.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed up for every imaginable deployment. We went to Fallon. We went to I think three times to Fallon and the one time to Red Flag down in Nellis Air Force Base,
mm-hmm,
which was really good. That was a great exercise. And kept the guys busy and on the step. And as I told them when I took over the squadron, that I wanted to be ready for the next conflict, and then because I didn't feel we were totally prepared
in
the last one, and I didn't want to have it happen on my watch that we weren't prepared.
Right.
So we trained hard, and I think we were one of the, of course I'm prejudiced, but I think we had one of the most effective squadrons that could have been, because we were engaged all the time in doing our business.
This is before you went to the East Coast?
Yeah, before I went to the East Coast and went on America.
When did you go over on the America?
Oh, geez, I can't remember the dates.
Was it like 80, 81, or?
No, I think it was in 77 through 79, I think is when I had, was in the A-95.
Okay.
Green Lizards.
Okay. And this
so
was...
I was over on cruise. We went to the Mediterranean, and I my tour was up in the Mediterranean, so I was we had our change of command in Naples,
mm-hmm,
and I came back. And my next tour of duty was to to another carrier. Surprise, surprise. I was going to be air operations officer on a carrier,
uh-huh.
and then operations officer. And this was the Independence.
Okay.
It was homeported out of Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
So Sandy and family and I came back to Norfolk from Whidbey, and I went to sea again, and it was, again, several cruises, went to the Mediterranean. In fact, I think, it was just before we went for the Mediterranean, I joined the ship,
mm-hmm.
and came back, went through the shipyard, which was never a good experience, major overhaul.
Why do you say it wasn't a good experience?
Well, number one, you're not at sea, and
right.
the ship should be at sea.
Right.
It sounds kind of funny, but it really
no, that
true.
Makes sense. I mean, yeah.
when you go into shipyard, they tear everything apart. A lot of your people are leave.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you transform back to going back to sea, you get a whole bunch of brand new people that have never been on the ship,
mm-hmm.
and you have to go through this laborious training program to get everybody ready to go.
Right.
And then you deploy, and it takes, there's a lot of heartache about getting ready to deploy, whether the shipyard will finish its work on time and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go through this graduated workup program that takes you from learning just how to steam the ship out safely out of the harbor and back to more complex operations.
Mm-hmm. How long does
that includes bringing on the air wing to have your flight deck crews learn how to operate airplanes, and you start that out slow by not very many airplanes, and then you add more airplanes and that kind of thing.
How long does this typically take?
The training aspect, about 6 months.
Okay. Is that trying, or is that something you know it's necessary? But
oh yeah, it's absolutely necessary. It's
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But it's trying in the aspect of you saw a ship that when it sailed into the yard proudly and it was all ready to go, and maybe it had some engineering deficiencies,
mm-hmm.
but you could work around those, and then you see this thing being torn apart as they run new electrical lines or electronic lines, and they put in new equipment and take out old equipment, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, we were putting in, making new berthing areas. So we
mm-hmm.
tore out complete berthing areas. Like,
wow.
I had 12. That was one of my jobs, was in the shipyard. I was in charge of habitability.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant taking these 12 compartments and ripping them out, totally out. We laid new flooring, put in completely new metal beds and the dividers and everything else, and brought these things up to really nice thing. But I had a problem. We knew what the schedule was, and we'd made the schedule readily apparent to NAV-C Syscom, which was the coordinator of all the maintenance efforts in Navy ships. And this the habitability guy, and I kept telling him, "Hey, you got to furnish me the equipment, because we'd torn all these things out
right.
as we were supposed to, and we were getting close to sail date, and the stuff was the metal berthing wasn't appearing.
Right.
I went to the CO to keep him informed. I was keeping my bosses informed all the way along, and
mm-hmm.
it was getting more toward crunch time, and
mm-hmm.
finally." The CO said, "Well, go ahead and write a message for me, and I'll send it." So I wrote up a real nasty gram to C Syscom,
mm-hmm.
telling him all the phone calls I made with this guy, and tell him that he had had plenty of advance notice to get the stuff delivered to the pier on time, and now we were getting to the point where we were going to have to sail with 1,000 people without beds or something
mm-hmm.
like that. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's not a good deal.
Right.
So that message, of course, reverberated up in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and was sent to the head. So the three-star got involved, and this guy called me the next next day, and he said, why did you send that message? And I kept telling him, I said, listen, I've sent you messages. I have telephoned you, and I kept meticulous records of all my dealings with this man.
Right.
And I said, hey, you just didn't do the job.
Yeah.
And he said, well, the stuff will be being delivered, blah, blah, blah. And of course, it got delivered, but the point is, at the end of the thing, it was my men who suffered
mm-hmm.
because they had to work overtime late in the evening every night to get these things done. And
right.
if it had been delivered in a normally prudent time, then these guys could have had liberty.
And you had to kick
so
them
we take it out of our men
right.
when people in bureaucracies don't do their job.
And you had to kick
this
guy in the rear.
And this happens all the time, unfortunately.
You had to kick this guy in the rear to get him to actually
yes,
get it done.
Absolutely. He would not have acted had we not sent that message.
Now, was this common in the Navy for you, or is this the exception?
This is common any time you're dealing with the bureaucracies, because the people in the bureaucracies, unfortunately, many of them are not Navy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any idea about schedules. They don't know what the impact of you can sit there and tell the man what the impact of not having berthing available when you go to sea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, it makes no impact. He had no foggy idea why, you know, I can't delay a couple of weeks. I mean, this is a construction job.
Right.
It's like, okay, if your house does, you know, if you're having a repair done on your house, well, construction guys sort of have their own timetable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, when you're dealing with ships and schedules, we have fixed timetables
mm-hmm.
and no slack.
Right.
And then we end up taking it out on our men, which made me furious.
Yeah. How long did you stay on the Independence?
I was there for 2.5 years, I think.
Okay. Do you want to comment on that cruise and your tour with the Independence? Anything? Any incidents happened?
Well, we went the Indian Ocean. That was an interesting. So we went through the Suez Canal.
Right. What was that like?
That was interesting. Very flat.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm reading a book right now called The Path Between the Seas, the creation of the Panama Canal.
Right.
And Lesseps and his genius of engineering in Egypt was compared to what he did in what happened to him in Panama. But since I'd been through it, I was now able to see what he was talking about. It was pretty easy to dig a ditch in a very flat, sandy terrain compared to going through mountainous and jungle territory with heavy rainfall.
Right.
But anyhow, it was flat, and you could see for miles,
yeah.
see the Egyptian defenses right along where the 67-day war was.
Right.
You could see all of that, and it was still there, some of it, like burned-out tanks and trucks and stuff. It was really kind of neat. And the Indian Ocean thing was very interesting because our biggest thing in those days was we had Russian aircraft that would come out and surveil the fleets.
Uh-huh.
And we had a practice that they should not come within 200 miles of the carrier without being under escort.
Okay. And could they call in to you and ask for escort?
Oh, no. They wouldn't talk to us.
Okay. I didn't think so. Okay.
No. They just came out, and it was our job to make sure they were under escort.
Okay.
So that you could say, essentially, it was like saying, okay, we see you, and if you come out here with a hostile intent, you know, we're going to get you.
Right.
That kind of game.
Right.
And, of course, they weren't coming out with hostile intent, but they were probing our defenses all the time and seeing
mm-hmm.
how well we did. Well, one of my jobs was to make sure that as ops officer, was to make sure that these incursions were met successfully.
Right.
And I had a CO of the ship, and I won't tell you his name, but this guy didn't like to be woken up at night, and he was a very autocratic officer,
mm-hmm.
and he was very profane when he was woken up or anything else. And I would wake him up early in the morning. I mean, this was like 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that,
mm-hmm.
after I'd been woken up and gotten an intelligence brief and all that stuff. And and talked with my experts and figured out when they would be out and where we had to make the intercept and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd call him up after all that was figured out, so I had a good plan of action. And then he would get mad at me for waking him up and cuss at me and everything else. And so I was sitting in combat on one chair, and the other chair was the ops officer of the Admiral staff was sitting in. Of course, he could overhear the whole conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I would then wait about 5 minutes and call him again.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd yell at me again and cuss at me and tell me I was, bothering him. So this went on. I kept finally, I said, "Captain, you've got to get out to the bridge and order the launch, because only the captain can do that."
Right.
So he begrudgingly got up and went out and launched. By that time, we were late in making a normal intercept.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to launch the tankers because the fighters, the F-4s, were the ones that made the intercepts. And
mm-hmm.
Normally, they didn't need any gas if you did it normally. But if they had to go out real fast, then you had to have airborne fuel for them.
Right.
Well, the Admiral, of course, found out about the whole incident and just was steaming. In fact, he was in combat when I had to finally just order the captain to get out of bed and go make the launch. And of course, as soon as this evolution was all over, he asked the captain to come down to his staff office,
and mm-hmm.
apparently he just screamed it, and he should have. The guy was incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very interesting period of my life. Not the most fun one, I might add. It was probably my most least enjoyable time in the Navy, and yet I had planned to do so much and had my own thoughts of how a good ops officer could really help in running a ship,
mm-hmm.
and running the exercise and everything else, and I felt my talent was totally wasted because I was always trying to figure out how to get this guy to react.
Mm-hmm.
It was not fun.
Yeah. Was this the first time you had cruised in the Indian Ocean?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
We made port calls to Mauritius and Sydney, Perth, Australia. So that was nice.
Wow. Okay. So what happened when you got off the Independence?
Then I went to Sinclair Fleet as a command watch officer for a short period of time,
mm-hmm.
and that's in their command center.
Mm-hmm. Where was this?
And this is in Norfolk.
Okay.
Atlantic Command. In those days, it was Atlantic Command and Sinclair Fleet,
mm-hmm.
so it was a joint command. But we had part of the finger on the nuclear trigger, if you
mm-hmm.
will, so we had to run those kind of drills,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the watch officer's main responsibilities, if you had to go through those tests.
Right.
And then, we had to watch basically anything that came up of great importance anywhere that had the Atlantic area in command. You had to keep everybody informed as a watch officer.
So right.
It was an interesting tour, but I made captain at that point. I didn't think I would after the problems with my CO. I thought I was dead,
right.
dead in the water, but I did get selected for captain, and then I was assigned as a carrier scheduling officer for the Atlantic Fleet in the ops area. So,
what year were you promoted? Do you remember?
Let's see, 80. I think it was 80.
1980?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so then, I was in operations, which was my bailiwick, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that and enjoyed doing that. And then one day, this is about a year later or so, I got a call from an admiral friend of mine who was over in Sacklant, that's
mm-hmm.
the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, the NATO command,
mm-hmm.
which is right next door to Atlantic Command.
Mm-hmm.
in that same complex in Norfolk there. And he said, we need a guy, a captain who has nuclear experience, blah, 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 to go relieve a fellow who is retiring in Belgium. And the relief that they had planned for him fell through. And I won't go into all the detail, but basically they needed somebody right now.
Right.
And I was available. And I said, well, let me, like a jailer says, let me make one call to Sandy and see, mm-hmm. see how she thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I called her, and I said, I have a chance to go to Belgium in this job and to be deputy Sacklant Rep Ure in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And but I have to leave very soon, like within a week, to get over there. And what do you think? She said, let's do it. So that's how we ended up in Belgium for 4 years.
Wow, so four years over there.
Right. And I was the deputy to a three-star foreign officer,
mm-hmm.
who was the Sacklant representative in Europe at the NATO headquarters in Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
That was really a nice tour. Professionally, not so great, mm-hmm. because it was kind of boring.
Yeah.
Professionally, because my job was social and primarily and taking notes at meetings and things like that. There wasn't anything operational about it. It was more political.
Mm-hmm.
But the chances for travel and for learning about different cultures and living in Belgium, which is really neat, was overshadowed anything. It was fabulous.
Right. This is a
great trip.
I can imagine you did.
Yeah.
This is in the midst of the Cold War, is just really boiling at this point. What was it like to be involved there in the early 80s in Europe?
Well, it was a very interesting time. We were there in Belgium when the Red Faction was famous, infamous in Germany, and
uh-huh.
also in Belgium. We had the Army Support Activity building was blown up, which is the one we use for our daily cashing checks and
mm-hmm.
doing all kinds of things that were U.S.-type stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
It also was our housing office and all these other kind of support activity that was blowing up while we were there. So it was a very interesting time.
Yeah,
there was a lot of concern about you'd be targeted, but
by
I
whom?
Didn't really feel too alarmed about it all, because I don't think at those times they were targeting people so much as symbols.
Targeting whom, Ken? By whom? Terrorists?
By the Red Terrorists.
Okay.
That was that group in Germany, and they had elements in Belgium.
Right.
In fact, all over Europe, I guess. But there was a lot of activity going on, and it was also during the time, as you recall, that the NATO allies were having a big discussion whether they were going to counter the weight of the. Medium-range missiles that were being set up in East Germany,
right,
toward NATO and various other places. And NATO, the United States was after NATO to make a response, because
mm-hmm.
it was one of these things: do you want to, if a medium nuclear missile was fired at some place in Europe?
Mm-hmm.
Then our only response, if we didn't have some kind of a counterweight, our only response was a massive nuclear strike on Soviet Union.
Right.
Now, and people want, we didn't want to be put in a position where we had no option to counter a medium strike.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we went through much deliberations on that, and I happened to be, one of my jobs over there was I was on the nuclear planning group, which was a very interesting group of what I consider junior diplomats.
Mm-hmm.
These would be mid-level career officers who were probably the cream of their diplomatic corps.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sent to NATO to be in this nuclear planning group. And they would discuss all these various options and we'd have meeting after meeting, getting the feed, and then they in turn would feed back to the foreign ministries what everybody was thinking about these issues,
mm-hmm.
and then hopefully come to some kind of deliberative process at NATO, these ministerial meetings, and so that they finally ended up deploying the medium-range missile. But all that was something that I was a part of, and it was very interesting. Like I say, I was mostly just a note-taker because I didn't, I wasn't formulating any of these kind of policies. These policies were probably more formulated in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and then articulated well enough, and then you went around trying to get support. Very much like any political process, you go around and round up your supporters and try to drum up other support, and saying, you know, demonstrating the need and giving intelligent briefings why these things were necessary and all that. And you had, of course, a very skeptical audience over there. It was not a monolithic institution by any means. Everybody had their own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But we played that game for many years.
Yes, we did.
Still playing it.
How serious was the Soviet threat in reality, or was it
a
lot of bluffing?
You know, it was interesting. We were over there, and the first time that I had thought of anything other than the Soviets being very strong, because of the we knew their gear was not sophisticated. Okay,
right.
we had seen that for years. Well, ever since World War II, we knew that their gear was manufacturing quality was not all the best, but they could put it out in tremendous numbers, and they could since they had a totalitarian regime, they could say they could put any amount of resources in it as they wished, and they didn't have a populace that had any power to say no. You ought to spend it on hospitals.
Right.
Well, the first time I realized the Soviet Union was in trouble, surprisingly enough, was we had a Sovintologist at NATO.
Right.
And this was I usually picked a visiting professor, and he would have a 2-year stint over there or something like that. And this guy was a professor of public health, believe it or not.
Okay.
But he had done a lot of work in the Soviet Union in their public health field. He was the only person at that time who had been allowed access, basically unfettered access, to the Moscow public library system and research system, because the Soviets, were very concerned about their decreasing lifespan.
Right.
And so they wanted to, he was an expert on that area, and so they wanted him to come over and do some research, and they liked his research, so they kept inviting him back. So he'd go over there every summer for like maybe 10 years or something, and he was finding out exactly what was happening in the Soviet Union. And so he gave a speech. Of course, it was all closed. It was a classified speech, but to any member of the delegation that wanted to come and listen to him, and it was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about public health, but it gave an inkling of how serious a problem they were in. And he was the one that said that the Soviet Union is a third world country with a first world military might.
Mm-hmm.
And he says things are very, very bad over in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
The health care is declining, and he gave many, many examples that were not necessarily pertaining to what we're talking about, but basically he just said that they are absolutely in horrible condition economically and health-wise. Giants.
Right.
So I said, yeah, they're, gave me an inkling that they were in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anybody there, while I was there, from 83 to 87, I don't think anybody had any inkling that the Soviet Union was going to implode like it did. There wasn't anybody that around that table that would have bet even a dollar that the Soviet Union would have collapsed that fast.
Why is that, do you think?
I just don't think anybody knew it. They just didn't have the knowledge that things were that bad in the Soviet Union.
4 years later, it's gone.
Yeah, it was incredible.
That's amazing. Yeah. I would have thought that you all right there on the front lines would have sensed this coming.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm still surprised that it went that fast.
Right.
Absolutely, just amazed because, you know, we had access to all kinds of good intelligence, but most of it was military intelligence.
Right.
And we weren't talking about people's lives and the poor roads and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
As long as our railroads could take their missiles to wherever they wanted them to go and where they were building their shipyards, were putting out submarines right and left every day, and they were doing this and they were doing that all over the world,
mm-hmm.
we still had to respect their military might, even though it was shoddy compared to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that, you know, that they had many major accidents in the nuclear program. We knew that they had problems everywhere they went. They had problems with mechanical things, but they were out there, and they were out there in numbers.
Right.
So we had to be respectful for them.
Absolutely.
And of course, you know, through the years, we've had these collisions at sea or near collisions at sea with the Soviet ships that follow us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they were there, and they were making themselves, and they were being kind of like little bullies.
Right.
So you had to respect what they had, and you didn't really know, you couldn't know from my aspect of really what the leadership would do. So I think that's more of a concern than anything, was the fact you had leadership that might do something. They never did, but
right.
they might do something that would be pretty audacious and horrible.
And you simply couldn't take the chance.
And you couldn't. No, absolutely not.
Right, right. Looking back on it, Ken, most people, most historians, or a lot of historians, and a lot of folks in general believe that the United States won the Cold War. And from your perspective, A, did the United States win the Cold War? And B, how do you think we did that?
Well, I think there is no doubt that we won it two ways. One, we maintained the will to be to counter their moves. Number
mm-hmm.
two, we are and were then and are now the economic powerhouse of the world. And the Soviets appreciated that, and
mm-hmm.
they knew very well they didn't want to try to counter us directly.
Mm-hmm.
But they were doing their best to work around the margins and take over, maybe, if you will, the areas of the world that provided a lot of raw materials, like
right.
Africa. And they would have loved to have gotten into the Middle East and Iran and places like that. And obviously Southeast Asia, the maritime routes and various supplies that come out of Southeast Asia.
Right.
So they were working on the margins very assiduously. And that's what our containment policy, I think, was all about, was to try to not let them get any gains
mm-hmm.
or many gains. And this, is, of course, goes back to why we were there in Vietnam, is because we didn't want them to have a dominance in Vietnam, which would lead to the Cambodia, Laos, and then maybe possibly Burma, and who knows, Thailand, and, you know, that kind of the domino theory type of effect. But they were working very hard all over the world in these areas. They had a strong military, but I think over our biggest thing, other than our will, and I think most ably represented by Reagan, was
mm-hmm.
that was our economic strength.
Right.
They knew we could, if punch came to shove, push came to shove, they would we could outproduce them, and they were terrified of it. And they were terrified of our outproducing them, not only, maybe not in exact numbers, but in our capability, our sophistication of product.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they still were bullies, and when they thought they could get away with it.
What role did Vietnam play in that? You mentioned that briefly, but in general.
Well, I think there's no question that the Soviet Union supported the Vietnam effort very greatly, and direct military supplies, and politically,
mm-hmm.
and so that, you know, if they were successful, they could be a client state of, in fact, they wanted Cam Ranh Bay, which they got after Vietnam collapsed.
Yes.
So they were there and waiting to take advantage of having a client state, if you will,
mm-hmm.
another one, on the periphery. So
right.
What I say, they were working on the margins. They were trying to reduce our influence, obviously, and
mm-hmm.
we were trying to protect whatever influence we had and allow people to grow naturally.
Right. Tell me, Ken, after Belgium, where did you go?
Well, then I got orders to come back at the safety center in Norfolk,
mm-hmm.
where I was director of aviation safety,
mm-hmm.
and that was for 4 years until I retired in '91. So my job there was it was the largest department in the safety center, and it's the oldest of our safety efforts in the Navy, is aviation safety. We've had aviation safety long before we had ship safety and driver safety and all those other safety programs that we have today.
Right.
And we had established years ago, understood the importance of computerizing all of our data, and we had, using old computers and punch cards and all that stuff, we had started assembling all the aviation accident data that we had,
mm-hmm.
starting with World War II,
mm-hmm.
and going through, up through to modern day.
Mm-hmm.
And we have prevention programs. We also sent out the accident investigators to go to the scene of an accident and go through the wreckage, just like the FAA sends out their team.
Right.
If it's a civilian accident. Well, we send out a team every time an airplane goes down throughout the world. And if we can get to it, we also dive, send out salvage ships to recover wreckage if we can find them. And we'll recover as much wreckage as we can, and then we'll disassemble it and look at all the parts and try to figure out what happened if we can.
Right.
Very interesting job. We also publish a magazine called Approach, and we were publishing one called Mech, which was based, focused on the enlisted troops who maintain our airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And that we would talk about maintenance practices and how to do things right in maintenance,
mm-hmm.
with real world examples, so people say, you know, we're not just blowing smoke, but we actually have pictures of people doing it wrong and what the consequence can be. And we've reduced our maintenance accident now to almost nothing.
Right.
And our pilot error, of course, is still the big issue, and we're working on that.
Mm-hmm.
We've come down even since I left, but we were coming down as I was there, making good effort on analyzing why people are having the problems they're having and trying to prevent them in the next time.
It sounds like you spent a lot of time in your naval career after your primary pilot years as overseeing safety, overseeing and doing a lot of teaching and training and,
mm-hmm.
and overseeing the safety aspect. Did you enjoy that?
I did, very much. I thought it was worthwhile.
Right.
Motivation. I thought it was absolutely worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ken, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Okay.
Stop.
All right.
Okay. Okay, Ken. So you retired in '91.
Right.
Did you find your naval career satisfying? How do you feel about
absolutely.
It today?
I loved every minute they had to throw me out.
Was it simply a 30-year deal and that was it?
30 years, right.
Okay. Do you miss it?
Let's put it this way. I miss the people.
Okay.
People were the best people that you could be associated with in any career.
Okay.
The quality of people, both officer and enlisted, were in aviation were of the finest. The officers were all type A personalities, full of life, very there were a few that were not smart, but by and large, it was they were really highly gifted, smart people, full of life, loved life,
mm-hmm.
and enjoyed. I think the common goal, even was if they didn't make it a career, there was a common goal and purpose in what they were doing, and most of them thrived on it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about looking back at your Vietnam experience. How do you feel about your service in Vietnam today?
Oh, I'm very proud of it. I think we did make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Meaning the
In spite of all the handicaps we were faced with, I think with what we were able to do, we did about as good a job as you could do.
Are you talking about your specific squadron or the United States in general?
Well, I'm saying I think the military effort.
Okay.
Political effort, I do not agree that it was very good at all. Again, that was a matter of will, and we didn't have a will for it. The involvement.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, there wasn't a recognition of how difficult it would be. Very much of the same kind of complaints you hear about Iraq today. There
mm-hmm.
doesn't seem to be an appreciation of how difficult it is to effect change, especially through military means.
Right.
But the military, I think there's some goof-ups that we did, but overall, I think the military did a hell of a job there under just the most trying circumstances. And for those guys who fought in those jungles, and I think won, again, with one hand tied behind the backs, did a marvelous job, and we tried to support.
Do you think the United States learned lessons from its experience?
Well, I was hoping so. I was hoping that, in fact, there was some really good recommendations that came out of it, that we should never go into war without a firm commitment by the leadership and the Congress, and with agreement with the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think was articulated very well by Secretary of State Powell.
Right.
And if we could learn that and understand that philosophy, I think we would be very well off as a nation.
Are you speaking of the Powell Doctrine? Go in with hard force, with
yes.
a purpose, and then get out?
Well, yes. And okay. also to have commitment.
In yes. other
words, to have committed people throughout the whole effort, not just one segment of government or one group of people, but
mm-hmm.
you have to have a consensus that you're going to commit with a limited goal, or with a defined goal, I should say.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I ask in these interviews, Ken, is something that we've already talked about a bit, is how relevant Vietnam is today. And is the Vietnam War still with the United States today, or has it been properly put to rest?
Well, That's a hard question, because I think you'd probably get a lot of different responses depending everybody's view of the war. But I think the experience is very much with us. I think it lives today.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have the same elements of the media, of the liberal establishment, and I don't say all that with disdain, but I do believe that there's a lot of people who will use a cause to be against what I think the nation was founded on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we are the beacon of hope and freedom of the world, which was articulated by many of our founding fathers, but also by people like Reagan and others. And there's a liberal cast that says, no, we shouldn't do that. We should be more accommodating, better. But these kind of policies have never worked against tyrants. And that's why I'm so against that kind of philosophy, is they don't work against people like Saddam. They don't work about anybody. I mean,
mm-hmm.
look at our friends, so-called friends, Chirac and those. Chirac does everything for France. mm-hmm. and as he should. I'm not saying that's wrong, but the people think that you're going to convince him to do something for America at France's, maybe France's best interest? Are you kidding me? They were happier selling all that stuff to Saddam than they were in supporting us in any kind of effort. But the liberals and the media people that are of that ilk never get that. They just don't understand it. And that distresses me a little bit. But, hey, it's a democracy, and I fought for it, and I'm glad I fought for it, and I'd fight for anybody's right to say whatever they want.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that the war has most affected your life, the Vietnam War?
Well, from a career military aspect, having combat in your jacket is certainly not a bad thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, from a very selfish point of view, I think it certainly didn't hurt me to have that experience. I think I could have. There are other people who never saw combat and did it just as well as I did. So it's no precursor to success, but it certainly didn't hurt.
Right.
Other than that, it had very little effect.
Do you suffer any disabilities from your time in Vietnam?
No, none.
Okay. Would you change anything about your Vietnam experience, if you could?
Yeah. I would have liked to have been able to hit targets that I knew were there.
Right.
Done a lot more damage and made them quit faster.
Right.
Yes. I just felt it was horribly run, and the campaign was run poorly. The air campaign was run poorly. A lot of it was because of political constraints, but it was not an efficient way to conduct a war.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible to see. What I resented most about it, other than the fact that I think it hurt our country, is it hurt people, individuals. I really believe that it cost us men and materiel, but it certainly cost us men that I saw die,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't like it at all.
Yeah. Personally, Ken, what was the most significant thing you learned about yourself during your three cruises over there?
Well, I'd always hoped to be a warrior, kind of grew up thinking, even as a child, that I was. And I think I acquitted myself pretty well. I felt I could handle the stresses of combat. I felt I was a real warrior, and I was proud of that effort.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever want to go back and visit?
I don't have a great desire to do that, no.
Why not?
Well, I just don't much care for that part of the world.
Okay.
I don't enjoy jungles that much. I don't enjoy high humidity.
Mm-hmm.
If I had my choice of visiting, I'd rather go to Canada.
That's kind of ironic, you say that.
Yes, I know. And I stated it that way for that impact.
What is your perception of Vietnam today, the country?
Well, I think it's struggling. It still hasn't been able to advance as it should have. It suffers. I'm real into economics, and I love to read the Wall Street Journal and various other publications that give an inkling to how trade policies are going and all
mm-hmm.
this kind of stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
so I'm always fascinated to read how they'll open up their economy a little bit, and then the bureaucrats, who by and large now are about as corrupt as you can imagine, having a state run everything,
mm-hmm.
Will retract whatever advances have been made and withdraw because they become frightened that the people are going to get too much power.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fascinating to watch how it has evolved. But it's a lot poorer than it should be because
mm-hmm.
it could be a very rich country, potentially. It could
mm-hmm.
be fabulously wealthy. And it's just kind of sad that the people are still suffering after years of being, having sent all their ex-military people that fought on the West to re-indoctrination camps and all that other stuff. And but I'll tell you, we have people here in Virginia Beach that are Vietnamese, and either came over from the boat or came over afterwards. And I'll tell you, they are so happy to be here. They try like heck to get their relatives out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that, still that sad of a situation that they don't have freedom there. They don't have a freedom, free enterprise system, and they suffer from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it will continue until for many years. And all past all this old leadership has died away, or most of it has. You got the bureaucrats who are the communist-type bureaucrats,
mm-hmm.
central planning and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're corrupting. They're being very corrupted. So it's a pathetic situation. I feel for the Vietnamese people greatly, because I know it could have been better.
Let's talk about the Vietnam veteran today. Do you think the government's taking care of Vietnam veterans in the way it would take care of any veteran?
Well, I think the Vietnamese veterans, think that most of the publicity has been on the failures of the veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them having to do with psychological problems that probably started when they started puffing marijuana and taking cocaine and illicit drugs,
mm-hmm.
or they had alcohol problems, and these resulted in the social problems that they're faced with. And
mm-hmm.
and I kind of tire of the homeless Vietnam veteran kind of thing, because the guy is sick.
Mm-hmm.
He's no different than any of his other misfits in society, or psychologically deficient, or mentally deficient, or psychiatrically deficient guy who's wandering around panhandling in the streets today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the effort should not be on publicizing that aspect of it, of the health care issue, but is getting better mental health to all of those guys,
mm-hmm.
or all of the people, both female and male, walking around with these kind of problems, because we've done away with most state mental hospitals. So the people that could help them in, let's say, in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
those hospitals and those people are not even available to people today. I know in Virginia, per se, we cleansed our hospitals of the mental hospital patients, put them in halfway houses, and when they don't work there, guess where they end up? They're in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them end up on the street because there's no law that says they have to remain in a halfway house, even if they're very deficient,
mm-hmm.
as an ongoing citizen. So we've got another whole issue that hasn't been even dealt with by anybody because of the cost involved. And I don't believe it's just the Vietnam veteran. I just think they are one segment of a bigger story.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I do not feel most of the Vietnam veterans are that they get the painted as all the homeless. But I really believe that there's millions of Vietnam veterans out there who are making productive lives, just like people in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But they just got a lot of press because this fed to the anti-war stuff too. This was helpful to the anti-war people and the skeptics who were against our policies. This made them, that was another nail to put in a coffin. You could just say, oh, see, this is what war causes, what the effect of our war was. You have all these homeless vets. You have all these people who are having flashbacks. You have all these people who are on cocaine because they were in BS, man, BS.
Mm-hmm.
They were there because they've got a psychological problem or a mental problem, and or an addiction of the sort that they could have picked up over there. I'll grant you that, because there was plenty of cocaine and marijuana in Southeast Asia, which they got a lot of, you know, on ground. They were, I mean, at least they had access to it, whereas their sailors probably didn't.
Did you see any of that stuff on board ship?
No, I never did.
Okay.
I mean, I know that there was some of it, but it would be more or less in the area of probably marijuana.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that I didn't see drug problems in the Navy. There were some, lots of them.
Right.
But at the time I was over there, we didn't see much.
Ken, let me ask you, what would you tell a young person today if they asked you about Vietnam? And you talked about the policy stuff, and I can imagine you would talk about that to an extent, but you know, if you walked into a classroom, say in a high school classroom, what would you tell them about Vietnam?
Well, I'd tell them, you know, basically what I've told you about my philosophy of why we were over there, what we were trying to do. I thought it was the goal was excellent. I just think we had no political will to carry out the policies, nor did we have the financial funding priority to make it happen without the serious effect on our economy, which of course it turned out to be disastrous economically to our country, to run the Great Society program and the war at the same time. We damn near bankrupted our country doing that. But that aside, I would just go on to say that when political leaders make decisions, they on something as important as giving away American lives, it should be more input from Congress or better sold by any administration, and so that you have essentially the Powell Doctrine.
Right.
But I would say that the people that fought over there, they did it courageously. They did it against great odds. They were spit and reviled when they got home, and it wasn't fair. But they were doing the best they could being sent there, not of their own will, but because the nation said you would.
Ken, have you been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I have.
Can you talk about your experiences there?
Well, I enjoyed going. Beautiful architectural art form, and I thought it was neat to have all the names there.
Were you able to find Mike's name?
I found all my squadron mates and others who were that I knew. No problem.
Okay. Ken, let me ask you a couple questions about this experience of being interviewed about Vietnam. What are your thoughts on it, and how has it affected you?
Well, I'm just happy to be able to make a statement based on what I knew and what I experienced, and certainly hasn't, you know, I don't think it's affected me one way or the other. I'm just happy to do it.
Right. Okay. Was there anything else that you would like to add to our discussion? Anything that you would like to comment on?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. All right. Well, this will end the interview with Ken Craig. Thank you very much, sir, for your time.
All right.
Okay.